Welcome to this month's live stream. It is my honor and privilege to be joining you from the global headquarters of the world's best capitalized bank, headquartered in the world's best capitalized country. This time, we are going to be talking about the Fed, their 50 basis point cut. We're going to be talking about U.S. elections. And of course, at the end of this, our favorite part is trying to answer some of the questions that we get submitted live while we're doing this. As always, I've got a cavalcade of stars to do the heavy lifting. And we're going to start with Jason in the U.S. And tell us about what's going on with the U.S. elections for the two or three people on the planet who may be unaware that there's an election going on.
Well, I'll do my best to bring them up to speed. And if they at least were under that rock for the past month, I think the bottom line is not much has changed in terms of the U.S. election outlook really over the past month. The one major event that had occurred was the debate between former President Trump and Vice President Kamala Harris on September 10th. Surveys afterwards suggested that Harris won. This is the public perception, and she won quite convincingly. But the poll results haven't really changed. They're still very, very tight. Effectively, it's a statistical dead heat at this point in time between kind of, Trump and Harris. And that has not really moved much over the past month. Prediction markets, did change a little bit after that debate, giving a little more probability for Harris, winning the election. But it's still, very close, around like 55% to 47%, something in that range. Given this hasn't moved very much and there's not at the moment another debate scheduled kind of coming forward, it's quite possible this could be the trend for the next 6 weeks until the election. Consequently, our CIO, kind of the probabilities we put on different scenarios haven't really materially changed over the past month. The highest likely scenario that we see right now is a 40% chance of Harris winning the presidency with a divided Congress where Republicans have the Senate and Democrats have the House. 15% probability that it's a blue sweep, so the Democrats win across the board led by Harris. So in total, that's a 55% probability of Harris winning the presidency. On the other side, we have 35% probability of former President Trump getting reelected and Republicans getting full scope of control of Congress, 10% that it's a red, that it's a divided Congress. So kind of bottom line, 55-45 for Harris versus Trump. That hasn't changed. It's sort of consistent with kind of prediction markets. There's always a possibility of sort of an October surprise, as in 2016. But at the moment, there's not a clear event that we can point to that would suggest this will be a catalyst for potentially changing the dynamic, at least at this point in time.
Okay, well, you rattled off a bunch of math there. But I think part of what the math you said was in most of the scenarios, or the most probable scenario, is divided government. Can you walk us through that, what that might mean in terms of policy?
Well, there are two big kind of trade policy implications. One is on trade and tariffs, and the other is on taxes. So starting with the trade and tariffs, both candidates have proposed, continuing to be a fairly aggressive on the tariff front. In particular, former President Trump has talked about the idea of a 60% tariff across the board on all imports from China, as well as a 10% tariff on all imports from every other country into the U.S. These are quite significant and potentially onerous. And it's unlikely that he would be able to, want to push through all that given the potentially negative economic implications. But it's just to be clear, president, whether it's a President Harris, President Trump, they have a fair amount of discretion in terms of what to do on trade policy determining tariffs. Flipping to Harris and what she could do, I think it's more likely to be a continuation of what's happened under the current Biden administration. It's noteworthy that the tariffs that Trump imposed on China, Biden has maintained. He hasn't increased them, but they've imposed policies such as restrictions on semiconductor sales, restrictions on importing Chinese electric vehicles into the U.S. So it's likely Harris will maintain that approach, be kind of selective, but continue to be sort of tough on trade. Ultimately, when we think about the different possibilities, regardless of the presidential outcome, we think there are kind of three different kind of scenarios. So one would be, 10% chance that we get, these really significant tariffs kind of across the board. So low probability of that happening. A 40% chance of what I'd say is our selective tariffs. Think back to 2018, 2019, sort of the tariff exchanges between the US and China on selective goods, something along those lines. And then about a 50% chance of kind of gesture tariffs, meaning selective tariffs on certain areas to send political message, perhaps to other countries, to enhance negotiating positions. Maybe it's a strategically important industry that the country, the US, wants to kind of protect. So I think the worst fears of what could materialize, we think that's low probability, but that's certainly a risk. Just flipping quickly to the tax front, there's two things we sort of know with some certainty. The first is that the personal tax cuts that were implemented under President Trump back in 2018, those are set to expire at the end of 2025. So regardless of the makeup of Congress, of who's a president, a key focus for Washington next year is negotiating how much of those tax cuts are extended. The second thing to we sort of know with some certainty is that any tax changes have to pass through Congress. So it's not just the president that matters, but who controls Congress. And given, Mark, as you alluded to, pretty high probability of a divided government, that means the potential scope for tax changes are somewhat limited. At the moment, we know President Trump wants to extend all those personal tax cuts, even lower them in some cases, lower corporate tax rates. Harris has pledged to have the tax rates remain the same for households making less than $400,000, but raising capital gains taxes, maybe raising the corporate tax rate. But again, I think the magnitude of what they can do, given this of the constraints in Congress, given the budget constraints, is more limited than perhaps what we saw in 17, or also in terms of fiscal policy and post President Biden getting elected.
All right, thank you. And now we're going to turn to Carolina to get an update on what's going on with the Fed. 50 basis points, that was more than some people anticipated. Is the Fed panicking? What's going on?
Yeah, so certainly, Mark, the Fed really has started the easing cycle here with a bang, really on the strong foot, as you mentioned, cutting interest rates by 50 basis points. That is somewhat unusual in that historically, such a magnitude of a rate cut is really mostly seen in periods of economic crisis. However, the situation today is very different, couldn't be more different. In fact, the U.S. economy is in a very strong state. The labor market looks quite healthy, and financial conditions haven't really tightened. In fact, you could say they are today rather supportive of growth. So how to read this? I mean, rather than being a sign of panic, the way that Powell messaged it in the press conference really is that it's a sign of a strong commitment to not be behind the curve when it comes to the labor market. And basically, he went on to explain that the time to support the labor market is when it's strong and not when we see a rise in layoffs, at which point it presumably would already be too late. So that is a strong sign of commitment here. It shows that the risks to the dual mandate are in balance, and it really does, you know, reinforce our base case of the U.S. economy being, the so-called soft landing. So when it comes to, you know, the pace, the size of cuts ahead, we know that the Fed remain data dependent. They will take a meeting by meeting approach. However, in our base case that foresees some gradual cooling of the economy, further gradual disinflation, we do expect the Fed to be in a position where it can deliver a further 50 basis points of cuts this year, 100 basis points of cuts next year. And that is, in fact, now in line with the updated projections of the FOMC as represented in the dot plots.
One area where the elections and fixed income come together is, you know, when you get these policy implications around taxes or tariffs and things, the market starts thinking about things like inflation rate. And so it's a little hard to maybe get a signal about what's going on in the fixed income market, because maybe they're paying attention to the Fed, maybe they're thinking about the elections. I mean, we're certainly very aware that this is a multidimensional chess game going on. But Carolina, can you kind of walk us through the Fed rate cut side and what we're seeing on the in terms of fixed income strategies? Like what do we know maybe would be one way to describe it.
Okay. Start with easier. What we know is that the Fed has started easing. It is projected to be the first of many. And I think additionally, they also stand ready to really support the economy by cutting interest rates more aggressively than expected. So clearly what it means is that the potential for cash to deliver returns is diminishing, and the returns outlook could diminish quite rapidly in the risk scenario. So what that means really for investors is that they need to be thinking about how to secure durable income. Now, the good news is that there is good income to be had in fixed income. So while we have seen a move lower in bond yields year to date, and particularly in the last few months, as the market has anticipated the start of the easing cycle, we're still in a situation where bond yields today, really across most segments of fixed income, still remain relatively attractive in a historical context. Specifically, we are seeing bond yields that are still above the longer-term historical averages. And in some cases, particularly in the holiday space, they're still really towards the upper end of their historical range. And we think that is really an opportunity. It's an opportunity for investors that still have excess cash holdings to really think about locking in these attractive bond yields in order to secure a more durable income potential in the years ahead. Now, as part of that, we do still prefer medium duration investment grade bonds with a tenor of 1 to 10 years. That is what we think is going to be the sweet spot. We don't think we need to see a move lower in bond yields for that segment to outperform cash going forward. But given generally the elevated yield backdrop across, you know, many fixed income segments, as I mentioned, we also think it makes sense to have a diversified fixed income exposure approach, one that does include selective exposure to higher yielding segments such as high yield and emerging market bonds, given our outlook of a soft landing that has been reinforced.
All right, Jason, getting back into this, you know, I think that I've seen some data on close elections or elections where the White House flips have a lot of volatility. Maybe it's, you know, people price and reprice things. What should investors be mindful of?
Well, you're right, Mark. Certainly elections can cause volatility. In recent history in 2016 and even in 2020, the election outcome certainly had sort of market moving implications. So we need to be cognizant of these kind of impacts. There could certainly be surprise events between now and November 5th that cause market volatility and even, you know, post the election as well. But I think it's important to keep in mind a few other things when we think about what we would recommend, you know, our clients do in portfolios and what we would advise. You know, the first is that it matters also the makeup of Congress. And we discussed earlier, it's a tight race and it's almost, say, a 50-50 probability of how it goes, and you could have a divided government. Even if it's a sweep outcome, whether it's blue or red, the margins are likely to be very narrow, which also makes it more difficult to pass sort of significant kind of legislation. Another thing to keep in mind is that the, you know, historically, you see the markets rally going into the election, but also coming out regardless of the party. And there's also long-term evidence that would show that on average, the stock market, at least in the US, performs kind of equally well under Republican or Democratic administrations. So all that is to sort of suggest that, you know, we don't think, you know, investors should be making big portfolio adjustments in response to or in anticipation of a particular election outcome. They should very much kind of stick to what is their long-term plan, kind of stay committed to that. Yeah, there is volatility, there could be some risks, and it's better than to kind of approach this as an opportunity to maybe hedge those risks, protect your portfolio in certain situations. But essentially, you know, invest with your head, but you can vote with your heart. So, you know, don't let the politics interfere with what you're doing in your portfolio.
Given that it's so close, there is going to be volatility, hedging strategies, or, you know, can you give people some further advice?
Well, there's a few specific things that we're recommending. One, for example, is these are capital preservation strategies. So these would be, you know, actual outright kind of, you know, hedges, you know, structured solutions, ways that ensure that the loss to your capital, to your overall portfolio is minimized, that's what you're trying to protect. You may sacrifice a little bit of the upside, but it again protects the downside. So that's if you're concerned about how the election will play out, the consequences, that's one thing to do. Another thing that we are recommending right now, and it's most preferred among our asset class preferences, is gold. Gold can be a way to kind of hedge portfolios, you know, in different events, in different circumstances. And again, it's somewhat kind of, it's a risk off asset class, so to speak. So again, it's not a particular election outcome, just the volatility overall. Another kind of theme that we think is kind of playing out is the possibility of more reshoring, certainly in the US for different businesses. And that was one of the recommended ideas of, you know, after our recent House View update, to look at, you know, companies that would benefit from reshoring, specifically in equities, companies that could either be winners or losers depending on the election outcome. So for example, you know, energy companies in the U.S. could be bigger beneficiaries, at least on a relative basis under President Trump, whereas renewables might be, you know, relatively, you know, at a disadvantage. The reverse could be true under President Harris. So there's certain sectors where we think there's some opportunities. And then, of course, there's implications globally for, you know, the election outcome, the trade implications. So there's certain currencies that could be used to hedge, for example, the Chinese yuan. So depending on your situation, depending on your concerns, there's different ways to sort of manage potential risks to your portfolio.
Super. And, you know, we've heard about how, while the election's uncertain, Jason's just outlined some things to do. Carolina's outlined some things to do around the fact that right now, short-term rates are going down in many parts of the world. Karen, how would you want to bring it together with the key messages so that people, you know, stay focused on this idea that there's a lot more going on, good or bad, however you want to see it, there's a lot more going on than just the election?
Yeah, so we just published our fourth quarter outlook just last week. So hopefully many of you have had the chance to take a look at that. If you haven't, get in touch with your advisor. And we detailed six areas to focus on. The first is lower rates, as you just highlighted and Carolina spoke about in some detail. So I won't elaborate too much further there. But the idea that cash is getting weaker in terms of the returns it's going to be able to offer is clear, and therefore looking at alternative and more durable ways of earning income is one very important theme. A related topic to that is the fact that the Fed is cutting rates most likely more quickly than some of the other central banks. Some of the other central banks maybe started cutting rates a bit earlier. Maybe the situation of their economy or where inflation is a bit different. They won't need to cut rates as steeply. As a result, we think that the dollar is going to keep weakening. We've seen it weakening somewhat already in the past few weeks, and we think that trend is going to continue. So we think that investors who are perhaps holding dollar assets unhedged need to look at whether they should hedge some of that exposure. On the other side of the balance sheet, we think that the franc is going to be appreciating. So investors who maybe have franc loans because interest rates are quite low in Switzerland, but maybe they don't have franc assets or income, should again think about how they could maybe hedge some of those liabilities. Jason already touched on gold as well. We think that's going to be a beneficiary of that weaker dollar and lower interest rates, as well as some of the election-related issues that Jason spoke about. A third area to focus on is artificial intelligence. Obviously, that's been a really key driver of markets so far this year and as well as last year. We think there could be some volatility actually in the months ahead, and not so many AI-specific catalysts now that the earnings season is over. And if we get some chatter around the election and potential restrictions on technology trade, that could create some volatility in the space. But we remain convinced that this is going to be a key theme for the longer term. And we also see upside over the next 6 to 12 months. So if we get that volatility, we think that investors who are perhaps underexposed, maybe they missed the rally, they should use that as an opportunity to buy. And particular areas that we continue to like, semiconductors, they're the beneficiaries of all of this investment right now. And we think the mega cap tech are in the best positions to monetize that investment over the longer term. And they're still already seeing free cash flow growth. So semiconductors and the mega caps are the places to be within AI. Beyond technology, we focus on quality. So companies with strong balance sheets, a history of being able to grow earnings even during weaker periods for economic growth. We think that makes sense in an environment where, yes, growth is okay, but it is slowing. And we could see periods when markets start to worry about potentially a recession ahead. So we think if you've got that combination of AI and these quality stocks outside of tech, and there's lots of those in sectors like healthcare and consumer, we think that investors can be quite well positioned with exposure to growth and also these companies that can, you know, weather potential storms. Historically, we've seen that quality stocks have outperformed the broader market in the build up to and during recessions. Jason gave a great update on the election, so I won't go into any more detail there. Then a final area to highlight is on alternatives. where we think that investors who are looking to diversify portfolios more broadly and to alternative sources of return can look at areas like private equity and infrastructure. And private credit is an interesting area for investors who are looking to diversify and earn alternative sources of portfolio income. And hedge funds remain very relevant for investors who are perhaps concerned that changing interest rates might mean that equities and bonds may start moving up and down together. Hedge funds can add a source of diversification into portfolios. So six key messages for the fourth quarter: lower rates and the election, very important, but plenty of other opportunities out there to help grow wealth.
All right. You know, for the quarter ahead, I think those are great messages. They sound, of course, they sound very reasonable because I helped work on them. But I got to challenge you a little bit here, Kieran. So, you know, I think one of the things that we think in our base case is that markets can keep moving higher, but we also know that growth is moving slower. And so I'm just wondering if you can kind of take us through the base case that, you know, we think we're being realistic, not too, you know, overly positive.
Yeah, so just so everyone knows, the base case by June of next year, we're looking for the S&P 500 to rise to 6,200, so a decent rally from, you know, current levels. One key stat that I'll always say to people when they're asking about why should there be further upside is what happens historically to markets when the Fed is cutting interest rates but there's no recession. And the answer is an annualized 17% performance for the S&P 500 during those episodes. So if we can achieve a soft landing, if the Fed can achieve a soft landing, historically, that's been a really positive backdrop for markets because you've got growth that's strong enough to support earnings. And of course, you've got the cost of capital coming down. So very supportive basic backdrop for markets. And then I think it's important to look at earnings growth because that's obviously not only being driven by what's happening more broadly in the economy and with GDP, it's also being driven by a very specific story on artificial intelligence. And we are seeing still very high rates of investment that's leading to immediate earnings growth for some of the semiconductors firms. And of course, if that AI investment is proving to be productive, it should lead to future earnings growth for some of those mega caps who are putting that investment in right now. So, you know, earnings growth for US equities, it's, you know, close to 10% over the next couple of years, you know, each year. So, you know, even though valuations may have been getting elevated in the recent rally, you know, that will quickly start to erode away in terms of the excessive valuations if we start to see that earnings growth coming through. So supportive market backdrop, strong earnings growth, we think the markets can keep moving higher.
Okay. And, you know, not to set you all against each other like this is a presidential debate, but Carolina, Kieran just made a very persuasive case for the potential upside in equities. Why would we want to own fixed income here?
I mean, so basically the key point that I wanted to put forward is that fixed income bond yields are elevated. Clearly, they have come down to some extent. There is a near-term risk that we see a slight backup in longer-term bond yields, to the extent that some of those recession concerns could get priced out. But our base case really remains one of gradual cooling, gradual disinflation. That's an environment where you can see both equities and bonds continue to do well. Furthermore, in obviously a more risk-averse scenario where recession risks are heightened, I think that obviously, you know, high-quality bonds could continue to deliver returns here as well.
You know, and inflation is a challenging subject for the Federal Reserve. I think, you know, they underestimated it now, and then maybe they've overestimated it. Now they're cutting from a position of strength. But, you know, it doesn't look like anyone really has a handle on what drives inflation in a post-GFC, post-COVID world. Maybe arguably, or maybe we do. But, you know, how should we... Maybe we do, but there's a lot of talk about inflation in this election. So I want us to give clients some guidance about how they should be thinking about inflation and longer term bond yields from here. So, Carolina, once again, can you give us your view on how to think about that?
Yeah, so if we look at longer-term inflation expectations, they remain well anchored. Like you said, the Fed is easing from a position of strength. So policy is still restrictive. It will remain restrictive and so long as the policy rate is above the neutral rate. And so long as they really do, you know, focus on their dual mandate and not overly emphasize, you know, one over the other, at this stage, you know, inflation is still above their target. So I think, you know, it does make the case for a gradual pace of cuts. You know, we monitor inflation expectations. They look well anchored. If we were to see the balance more towards boosting the labor market, that could raise concerns on inflation expectations. It could start to move higher. But for where we are right now, we think that they remain well anchored. So actually, we don't see an opportunity at this moment tactically, for example, to go into TIS versus nominal thing.
All right. Now, I'm a little disappointed because I don't know if it's a technical glitch or people thought that was tremendously satisfying, but we don't have any more questions coming in. So I'm going to yield back like 3 minutes to all of the audience. Thank you all very much. We enjoy this. And let's work hard to fill it up with the questions. It's only going to get more exciting, in my view, until we get through the election. So thanks, everybody, and wish you all a great day. Bye-bye.
UBS Chief Investment Office's investment views are prepared and published by the Global Wealth Management Business of UBS AG or its affiliate, UBS. This material has no regard to the specific investment objectives, financial situation, or particular needs of any specific recipient and is published for informational purposes only. As a firm providing wealth management services to clients globally, UBS AG and its subsidiaries offer both investment advisory services and brokerage services. Investment advisory services and brokerage services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. In the USA, UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS AG and a member of FINRA SIPC. For information, please visit our website at ubs.com/workingwithus. For a full legal disclaimer applicable to the independent investment views produced by UBS, please visit our website at ubs.com/CIO-disclaimer.